Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
I don't need any help.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Thank you.
Wow.
Hello. Good evening and welcome everyone to tonight's program at the Commonwealth Club. My name is Ladaris Cordell. I'm a retired Superior Court judge and I'm thrilled to be your moderator for the program today. Joining us this evening is April Ryan, White House correspondent for the American Urban Radio Networks, a political analyst for CNN, and author of her new book, Under Fire, reporting from the front lines of the Trump White House. For over 20 years, April has been reporting from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Mm-hmm. She thought she had seen it all until Donald Trump arrived. Few would argue that President Trump's administration is waging a war against the press. The president and his former top aide, Steve Bannon, referred to the media as the opposition party and took the unprecedented step of banning cameras from the White House press briefing. Under Fire is the story of April's struggle to proclaim the truth in a new post-facts environment and how reporters are having to adjust to new rules in an unprecedented presidency. We're excited to have April here tonight to discuss these important issues and more. So please join me in welcoming April Ryan to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much.
So, April, I loved your book, Under Fire, and I think that this cover photo is just terrific. Y'all can see that it's like, I'm here, I'm going to ask my questions, and you can answer what you want, but I am always going to be here. I love this photo. It's great.
And thank you. Thank you. And it's crazy. That photo was, you wouldn't believe it, but it was taken on my iPhone. Yes. The publisher said, you know, we want a picture of you on the cover. And I said, okay, well, what do you want me to do? They said, go in the briefing room, sit in the seat. And I sat in the seat. I didn't like that picture. And then, well, first I said, it was like 5 o'clock in the evening and everyone was kind of like leaving or just trying to figure out what they were going to do for the rest of the evening. And I said, guys, can I, it was like three or four people. I said, can I get the room to myself for a minute? And they allowed me. And I asked a friend of mine, I said, take my phone. And I said, take some pictures from the podium. She says, is that all you want? I said, yeah, just take some pictures. And then we took the first initial pictures and I was just sitting there. I said, I don't like that. And I did that and that was it.
It's it. It is the it. One.
From the podium.
Right.
That means you cannot miss me
right.
from the podium.
So, April, a native of Baltimore, Maryland,
yes.
graduate of Morgan State University, a historically black university.
Yes.
A mother
black
of
college.
Two daughters.
Yes.
Member of the White House Press Corps for 21 years.
21.
So the first question I have is how did that happen? And can you give us just a brief look at the journey of April Ryan to the role of White House reporter?
My journey is non-traditional, to say the least. I am a product of two people who came from agrarian families. My mother from North Carolina, forgive me, Lord, because they'd be having a fit. North Carolina, and my father from Maryland. And in 1967, I was born to two people who just wanted to build a family together. I was the firstborn of that union, and I was very precocious. To say the least, and it took them 7 years to have my brother. So, but I grew up in a household where, you remember this, you know, that's the way it was. My father and mother watched Walter Cronkite, you know, religiously. And my mother, she was ahead of her time. She was an activist. She was on a college campus. She toiled at Morgan State University for 42 and a half years until her death. And I'm a HBCU baby. So She believed in people and she believed in advancing causes. And I didn't think I did, but sometimes when you're in a setting, it comes and just sits on you, and it sat on me. So with my dad, in the evenings, he would come home from work and he would sit down and watch Walter Cronkite. And I'm like, Dad, we'd listen to the local radio, local news. And I'm like, why are you always watching the news? I mean, it was so much of a big thing in my home to watch the news with those three stations at the time. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
and the white noise after Johnny Carson would go off, and you know that, you know, and the flag would come up at 5 a.m.
That's right.
I mean, I'm talking about that time.
That's right.
So my dad was watching news so much. I said, Dad, why are you watching the news all the time? And I should have, as a child, run from the news when he said this, but I just ran to it. I said, Dad, why are you watching the news? He said, because I want to know when the world comes to an end. I'm like, oh my gosh, you don't tell a child that. And me and my crazy self, I'm running to find out when the world comes to an end. So, and I believe now that I look back, that's where the foundation was laid for me. My mother was always into current events, and she knew what was happening. You know, I always knew about my history. I was that kid, you know, you sit at a kitchen table and you have a peanut. Do you know how many uses there are of a peanut? I'm like, oh, mama, George Washington Carver. If we talk about blood, Charles Drew. And if you don't know about it, Google it. My mother used to tell me, look it up. You know, when we had dictionaries without the internet, Google Charles Drew. You'd be surprised and fascinated. You know, and we'd stop at a stoplight. You know, a black man made the stoplight. Okay, mama. You know, and a gas mask. I mean, my mother always taught me about excellence in our community. I always knew what was going on because we listened to the news. And I don't know. I grew up understanding life, but I was never socially aware. You know, I went through college. I was a DJ in school, jazz DJ.
Any good? Were you good?
I was pretty good. Yeah. Hi, this is April Ryan, WEAAFM 88.9. You know, I can still do it. But you know, I was like, after a while, I was like, I can't, you know, I needed more. I didn't, time, weather, and tip, and I didn't have anything else to talk about other than, this is Sade. Is this a crime? You know, I was like, I said I need more, but I had a yearning for news. I wanted to get more information. So I started venturing into producing a news show, and I started into doing news. I remember my last DJ gig was at the station in Baltimore. It used to be owned by James Brown. Yes, James Brown. And then it was owned by Dorothy Brunson, the late Dorothy Brunson. And I remember, and I just said, this is not for me. And I had a yearning. I didn't realize it, for information. And that's where it started at school. My sophomore year, I started really getting into news.
So you finished college.
Finished college.
And then what?
I was working for a gospel radio station. Well, while I was in school, I was working at various radio stations and my checks were bouncing, but I was getting the payroll checks were bouncing but I was getting experience, and I worked at a gospel radio station, and I was telemarketing at the same time. I'll never forget. My father didn't want me to get in this business because what we knew of as black radio or black media, you wouldn't make money. They sent me to school so I could get off of their paycheck. Mm-hmm. So they wanted me to be independent. They wanted me to be someone who was living a middle income dream through obtaining my college degree. And he said, April, I don't want you in this business. I said, I'm going to prove him wrong. I'm going to prove him wrong. And I did prove my dad wrong. I worked hard. I mean, I went to Chattanooga, Tennessee, came back to D.C., Baltimore, D.C. I mean, I jumped around a little bit, but I honed my skills. And all throughout my time at this station or that station, I was that girl that always, oh, this is newsy. Let me send it to the network. I would always send little stringer feeds. And AURN noticed me when I was in Baltimore.
And AURN is
American Urban Radio Networks, the network that I'm working for currently, that has had me in that position for 21 years as a White House correspondent. So I was in Baltimore, and they saw the news stories that I was doing, and they liked it. And then what really sparked their interest in me, it was when it was in the early 90s, and you all may remember this, when the NAACP was having its big problems with then-President Ben Chavis. Mm-hmm. And I made a report. I went against everyone else. And that's what I like to do. I like to break the news, make sure it's factual, and then break it. And I said, it's not about if he would go. It would be how he would go and when he would go. And they're like, no, they're not gonna fire him. And sure enough, that weekend he was gone.
Right.
So I broke that, and they said, we got to bring her over. So I was green, very green. The White House, that place will eat you alive. Mm. I mean, and this was before the Trump era,
right? Right.
It would eat you alive. If you don't know, you won't know. It's kind of a thing where you're grandfathered in, and me being the new kid on the block from Baltimore. I mean, I did City Hall, State Capitol, and stuff like that, and did the Washington scene from afar. And I was also working on the local WTOP in Washington, the local news station, being a news anchor. But nothing prepared me for this.
So let's go then right to White House briefings. Mm. First, just tell us, I mean, I think we can imagine, but tell us the difference between attending a White House briefing in the Obama administration and attending it in the Trump administration.
Okay, one, there was a report today that there was only one press briefing for the month of September. That wouldn't have happened in the Obama years. It wouldn't have happened in the Bush years, and it wouldn't have happened in the Clinton years. So that's going to give you some extra presidents. Mm-hmm. but what's different is that we would time the briefings, and those briefings would last about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour and 15 minutes. You know, now it's like we're lucky if we get 12 minutes after she gives her opening statement. Sarah Huckabee Sanders. The she in the room.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm not being disrespectful when I say she. She's Sarah Huckabee Sanders. But here's what's interesting as well. She's strategic in who she picks on.
Mm-hmm.
She's strategic.
Obama was not, they didn't.
They were strategic, but they called on a lot of different people. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary, she likes to make sure that the conservative press is called on quite a bit. Friendlier questions, or those that are not, that they don't perceive as more hostile. I don't know what's hostile if it's something. Okay, let me say this. So during the Clinton years, during the Bush years, and during the Obama years, even when they were going through the hardest of times, they knew that tough questions about the issues of the day were coming. Mm-hmm. They were prepared. They answered them. They may have cut you off and gone to someone else, but someone else was going to pick up. This administration, they won't focus in. They make sure they might hit it once and move on. And maybe some other people might continue, but they don't like it. And she gets very defensive. And she'll move off of it and he'll shut it down. Watch how they shut down the briefings when they shut it down. You know, when it starts getting hot, you know it's getting ready to end. So, and you can see it with this president. They do not like the questions that puts them up against a wall or the hot topic of the day that they have not figured out the spin on as of yet.
Got it.
So, I hate to say that, but it's the truth.
Yeah. So can you give us a sense? You're April Ryan, you walk into the press briefing room and Sarah hasn't come out yet. What are you thinking? Are you fearful? Are you
fearful of what?
Who knows?
Judge. I know now in this moment she's not going to call on me, but I still raise my hand and I'll go, Sarah.
She doesn't call on you.
Not right now. No, she doesn't like me, and it's okay. It's sad. She doesn't like me. I mean, it's thank you. But I'm okay with that. I haven't done anything wrong. I have asked questions like anyone else in that room, but I am now singled out. Why?
Well, let's get to this right now. I want to talk about the question.
What? Which one?
You asked President Trump. You asked him a question that no one in the press has ever asked of a president.
Mm.
Do you know what question I'm talking about?
I know.
So
I asked it. I know.
All in the book. But so, what was the question? What was the answer?
There was no answer for that moment.
All right. What was the question you asked?
Before we get into
set
that,
the stage.
I'm gonna set the stage.
Yeah.
It's a very sad day when a reporter has to ask a president of the United States of America if you are racist. And every time, I mean, and I still, I've finished writing this book. It happened in January, and it still bothers me to this day. And I'm going to explain why. And I told you, you know, my beginnings. But I also come from that family who had the picture of King and Kennedy. That's not about my politics. That was about my parents' politics. But I still grew up understanding that so many of us stand on the shoulders of those great men. If it weren't for Dr. King, I wouldn't be in that room probably, really, truthfully. So let me set the stage. So you know my beat. I cover everything. I ask questions about all things. I asked about Russia when Sean told me to stop shaking my head. God bless him.
Mm-hmm.
What is interesting is that I ask questions about, my focus is on urban America. This is urban America. San Francisco is urban America, you know, no matter what color we are. So I was hearing this stuff percolating in the community. And through leaders, you know, he's a racist. Why were they saying he's a racist? Just before that King moment event in the Roosevelt room at the White House, white congressional leaders were leaving the meeting with the president on immigration, where the president was supposed to be giving his heart. It was about his heart. Remember that? And what were the words coming out of the heart meeting on immigration? S-hole nations, black and brown nations, but Norway was great. And the Homeland Security head didn't know that Norway was majority white, right? Okay. You can't make this up. It's the truth. Google it if you don't believe me. So then not long before that was Charlottesville, with comments about slavery and the Confederacy. It was percolating. You know, you were hearing things, what do blacks have to lose? That was in the campaign. All of this stuff built up. Frederica Wilson with Sergeant LaDavid Johnson. This stuff was building. And people were saying, and then that was just, and then just before that, before the asshole comments, he was talking about how Nigerians, if they leave their huts, they're going to come here and not want to go back. Remember that? I'm not making this up. So you had black leaders and white leaders, both. He's racist. I'm like, Now, words mean something. You have to be careful in how you label someone and what you say about someone, because that can stain them or even worse. So I said, let me call the NAACP, the leaders of the NAACP. And I asked them, I said, what's the definition of a racist? Because before you go out and do a story, you have to research it. You have to talk to leaders about it. I don't just sit up there and ask something out the side of my neck. I know maybe people think I do, but it's like it's already researched. So I was told, and it's so simple, the definition of a racist is the intersection or the meeting of power and prejudice. say it again. The definition of a racist is the intersection or meeting of power and prejudice. I said, okay, so we're off to the races. Mm-hmm. That was the night before. So I had not made a firm decision if I was going to ask the question because that day was so heavy to me. Dr. King means the world to me. I was that kid in Baltimore who, I was a latchkey child. Latchkey, if you don't know about it, Google it. I used to come home after school, walking home in my little Catholic school uniform. I was one of those bad Catholic school girls. But a Southern Baptist, but little Catholic school girl. I would walk home and go home. And I'm one of those weird kids. I wasn't supposed to go out until my parents got home. Stayed in the house. But you know what I would do? I would go to that component set that looked like a coffin. Not the component set, but it was a stereo system. Remember those old stereo mm-hmm. systems? It looked like a coffin. You slide the top over, you know? And I would go through my mother's 45s and 33s and 75s and put on the records. Dr. King, his I Have a Dream speech, his I've Been to the Mountaintop speech. I was that kid who would, that was weird. I should have been watching something else on TV or doing homework. I was listening to Dr. King and reading his speech. I mean, I felt it as a child. So he meant a lot to me. So I'm there that day trying to figure out, am I going to ask the question, should I, shouldn't I? And I didn't make the determination until I delivered it. That I was going to, because it weighed on me so much. And then after I asked the question twice and asked, Mr. President, you want to answer any question? He didn't answer. And I mean, I felt the weight of the moment. I felt the weight of what I'd done. I felt the weight of my history. I felt ashamed because I marred Dr. King's day. Because the president was there with Dr. King's niece and nephew, not the children, and Black Republicans to celebrate this man, this dreamer who's now, he was a marcher who's now a martyr, to celebrate the fact that they were expanding the land around the King Center. And here I come messing it up. That still bothers me.
Do you regret asking the question? Why not?
I called MLK, Martin Luther King III. And asked him. I want to apologize to you. He said, for what? I said, because I asked you. He said, no, you did the right thing. Mm-hmm. And it still bothers me because, again, you should never have to ask a sitting U.S. president if he's a racist. And then on that day, and I didn't realize how big the question was. It landed that weekend. I did not know. I made it a point to pull myself away from TV because I was so upset. And I just lived my life. And because it not only that, I mean, I had Pastor Daryl Scott. Mm-hmm. He was going to throw water on me.
You write about that.
Yeah, in that room after I asked the question. And other reporters were around. Yeah.
Right. So let me ask you this, though. I'm going to read from your book, and this is after the question was asked. As a reporter, you write, I have been lied about and talked about, all with an effort to discredit me. I have been harshly criticized by some and applauded by others. And then a little further in the book, you write, it's a job I love.
I do love this job.
So how do you love a job where you are seemingly, you have become the story?
As I get emotional right now talking about that, and it still bothers me. And I didn't realize, sometimes you don't face, when you face it, you feel it. And, this is what I studied for. This is my vocation. I didn't know all this other stuff was going to happen. But I love this job, and I'm not going to let anyone tear down my dream, my mother and father's dream for me, my community's dream, and those shoulders that I stand on. I will not. I love this job because I'm asking a question. I got to. No, I'm not going anywhere. I love my job.
Fantastic. I do have to tell you all that when April comes on, when she's on CNN, for example, as soon as we see that she's going to be on, I start yelling in the house, April's on! But get to the TV and watch it. So you have to know.
That's so
it's
funny.
Important. So let's go to a lighter subject.
Okay.
Have you read Omarosa's book?
No.
Unhinged.
I'm a who?
Unhinged. Have you read that book?
I'm a what? Who? No. No, and I will not. I will not.
And why is that?
Oh, Lord have mercy. Judge.
Well, in your book, you write about your interactions with Omarosa.
Well, let's talk about why I write about the interactions with Omarosa. Omarosa is the reason why all of this stuff happened. She started it, even though she's fired, the residue still is there. Omarosa and I touch on it. I don't. The book is not about her.
Right.
I don't have a tape. And I still am a bestseller. So. So forgive me, but Omarosa and I were friends. We were close. I loved her like a sister. While everybody was telling me, "Girl, she gonna cut your throat," I'm like, "No, no, y'all don't know her." I said, "That's just for TV." Little did I know, she hurt me. And we were backstage. And today, and it's crazy. Today I was looking, you know how when you're on a plane, 5.5-hour flight. And you, yes, I'm trying to figure out, you know, okay, what's going on? What do I do? You know, looking through my phone. And I look at my pictures. Oh, and I go back in time. Today was the first day I went back in time with my pictures with her. And it brought a tear to my eye. We were close. And I showed you some of the pictures. Our families knew each other. I went to her church. She took me to Skid Row where she ministered. And then this person, who is this? I'm like, so in my take, you're fine unless you get in her way. So.
Did you get in her way?
Apparently. It's sad.
We can leave it at that if you
like. No, I'll talk about it. I think it's cathartic. Get it out and breathe. No. So what happened was we were friends. But that friendship, I mean, she was, and it's not a myth, it's not conjecture. She worked for Bill Clinton. She was in Al Gore's office. When Al Gore wanted me to interview him, he would tell her to call me. And that's how we started. And back then, you know, we were both young, you know, 20 years. I was, 21, 51 now, whatever. Y'all do the math.
You're still young now.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, you know, we became friendly. And then after she left or got fired or moved up, failed up or whatever out the White House, you know, we'd run into each other. It's the truth. We'd run into each other around the country. And, you know, she'd be somewhere and I'd be somewhere like, hey, let's, you know, get together. And we got closer, much closer over the years. And but then long story short, when she became part of the Trump campaign, I became a target. The president did not like the press. Oh. I've got someone close. Oh, I've got a dean of the press corps. Oh, I can get her and make them think that I am in this camp. Make them accept me. That's what a friend will do. So I was in WikiLeaks, and I'm not mad. I don't care. They can talk about me on Twitter. I think it's a badge of honor that I'm in WikiLeaks. And the reason why I say that is because any reporter in Washington worth their pen and pad, their microphone and video camera should have been in WikiLeaks. And I say that because John Podesta, I've known him for a long time. And I was asking John Podesta, emailed him, why is it that Hillary Clinton is not doing so well in the black community? I said, we should have black reporters come together with her. And then so with WikiLeaks, I did see the back and forth exchange with Karen Finney and the rest of them. They're like, oh, April's wrong. It's not that bad. April was right. But what WikiLeaks doesn't tell you is that I was calling Donald Trump's people. I was calling his secretary at Trump Tower trying to get an interview. I was asking Omarosa. They don't tell you that I was talking to Ben Carson's people. They don't tell you I was talking to Ted Cruz's people or Jeb Bush's people. They don't tell you I was also talking to Bernie Sanders' people. That's what they don't tell you. But it's all one side. And then I'm supporting Hillary and I'm trying to do all this. So I'm like, whatever. So then, in her warped way of trying to make people think that I've done something wrong to cut our friendship off, she tells people I'm taking money from Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. Yes, that will kill a career. I've worked hard. My parents sacrificed for me, and they're gone to glory. And I would do them a disservice if I would have fallen under that trap. So I talk about it in the book, but all of this was in efforts for her to look good in this Trump administration. So when it comes to reading her book, no thank you. When it comes to her tapes, yeah, those are tapes. But like she taped me, she takes the portion that she wants you to hear. Mm-hmm. Put it in context and consider the source.
Mm-hmm. You write in your book, and I quote, "This White House wants to control the Browning of America."
Yes. And Michael Steele.
What do you mean?
Michael Steele, the former RNC chairman, even said that. We are a nation that at one time used to be proud of talking about Lady Liberty, how people came. You know, we used to always hear we're a nation of immigrants. No, we're a nation of natives, slaves, and immigrants. But the immigrant thing was really the prideful thing that everyone took to. Lady Liberty, bring me, you're tired, you're hungry. And how everyone would come through New York and see Lady Liberty standing there in the harbor. Now it's like, it's shameful for some. And when you hear people talking about a Muslim ban, who are they talking about? Mm-hmm. When they were talking about cutting off these visas, you know, and they got into this thing about, you know, oh, we don't want these immigrants coming on welfare. I said, wait a minute. And I'll never forget that night I was on Aaron Burnett, and I was on with Paris Denard and Joan Walsh and someone else. And they were trying to talk about the welfare, you know, the fact that the welfare rolls. I said, no. And they were starting to go down the line of black and brown immigrants. And I said, wait a minute, I remember. And see, this is when you're dangerous. When you've worked in prior administrations, you have recall about things. And you can pull it up. You can Google it for proof. So they were talking. I said, ho. And they had to go to commercial break. And I'm so thankful for the commercial break. I took my phone. I said, wait a minute. Center for American Progress. Black immigrants came up. Black immigrants are the immigrants who have more education and do better than the other immigrant communities. This was the Center of American Progress. And they were like, Paris was like, he ultimately told me to shut up on air because he was so upset. But, you know, where's Paris now? But that's a whole nother story. but no, it's a whole nother story. I'm not going to get into it. But no, I mean, that kind of thing. And then when the disparaging remarks about other countries, you know, S-hole nations versus Norway. And there is a concern. We are a nation that is now seeing the number of children being born in hospitals who are minority. The vast majority of children born in hospitals now are minority. We are a nation that's browning, and there is an attempt to roll it back. And if you don't believe it, just listen to the speak on immigration from Stephen Miller that the president gives.
Right.
Oh, Lord, y'all don't like him, do you? It's like you said names. Oh. Oh, my goodness.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
April, you write about something in your book called the emotional tax. Mm. What is an emotional tax?
The collateral damage on me, my children. My blood pressure has gone up. And that's the truth. Ask my doctor. It's not good, but I'm not leaving. It's stressful. When you come home, think about this. Think about this, and this is something that I know you all can relate to. When you have an argument with your significant other or don't want to be other, that's just between you and that person and your small group, right?
Right.
And it's a little embarrassing for that little group, maybe 20, 30 people at most, or maybe more, a little bit more. But think about it when you're on TV in front of the President of the United States or the press secretary and the world is watching. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't go to Wegmans anymore. Did you get that meeting together? I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. Tap, my kids are, you know, with me. It's hard.
And it's, that's your workplace.
That's my work. My workplace is now seen everywhere. And I'm like, and it's like, I've said this, I've had to really have a talk with myself. I've done nothing wrong.
No.
So I can hold my head up and walk. And in the book, and it's so funny, Kamala Harris, Senator Kamala Harris, last year said to me, yes, you can clap. She said to me at an award ceremony that during the Congressional Black Caucus annual legislative conference last year, not this year, she said, you keep going back. I said, and so do you. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know, again, that what really is my compass is the fact that I've done nothing wrong. I've done the same thing mm-hmm. for the last 20 years that I'm doing in these last two. And I think about something my mother took from Dr. King. It's not what they call you, but what you answer to. So I walk with my head held high. And I just thank my ancestors and my angels and all of you who sent support, because it's a good number that say nasty things on the Twitter and on the Facebook and on the Gram. But there's a larger number of people who are thankful, and I'm thankful to God for them.
Wow. Yep.
Yeah, thank you.
So you're awesome. Know that?
Oh, Judge. No, you're awesome.
So I'm going to include some questions now from our audience. Did you enjoy being on the Bill Maher Show with Steve Bannon?
Oh. Okay, so let's break that down in parts. How many of you watched Bill Maher? I was crying on that stage laughing. It was terrible. Terrible. It was a fun show. All right, so I'm gonna give y'all some truth, and you may not like it. But as a reporter, we have to go into situations or do things to, not do things, but go into situations and places and meet with people to inform you. I have, in the book I talk about this, I don't go upstairs anymore. The only time Sarah and I or some of those people in the White House will see each other is when we're in that room together. I don't go up there anymore. And when the president sees me, he makes this awful face. And I'm like, he does. He's like, I'm like, I'm not afraid of you. You can make all the faces you want. I'm going to do my job. he really gives me that face. So I'm like, okay, whatever. So, but I made it a point because I have said this. I said, I don't ever want them to say that something happened up there. Because after the Omarosa fight, well, that's in the book too.
Right.
And it was bad. I said, I will never go up there by myself because they'll say I did something. But luckily there were witnesses there. We didn't need, well, Omarosa taped it, but there were still witnesses there to prove stuff. But I said, I will never go up there so they can say something happened that didn't happen. So I never met Steve Bannon until that night. I told the producers, I said, I want to meet Steve Bannon. So I said, no, I want to meet Steve Bannon. I want to find out what's going on. So they said, oh. So to my surprise, Steve Bannon was like, yeah, tell her to come. I said, he really said that? I was shocked. So I go downstairs and I meet him. He said, I think you're really good. I'm like, but the president said he thought I was really good in that first press conference, and then look what happened. And I think he really meant that, but it just went south on him. He looked so bad with that, you know, are they your friends, get them together thing. And it just went. I know every black person in America. If I don't know them, I'm related to them. So anyway, Judge, you and I are related. Your family, North Carolina. Yes. So, I mean, but that was, it was a very much Al Bundy, Al Bundy, Archie Bunker moment that is history now. I mean, the history, but when you see April Ryan, that's the first thing. I mean, how do you think that makes me feel? I mean, you know, first thing comes up, she's supposed to get the CBC and the president together. That's a meeting, you know, but anyway. So, she's their secretary, but I never met him, and I gave him the what for on some issues. I'm not going to get into it right now because we're going to continue our conversation this week. That's all I'm going to say. And I want to get it on tape.
Good. It'll be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because let me say this. And the reason why Steve Bannon is important, whether you believe it or not, there's a thought that he was the de facto president at one moment in time. He was leading this country. And also, members of this administration have blamed him for the racist tone and behavior that's come out of the White House. And I asked him about that. And he denied it, but still, I want to hear from him. I'm going to listen. And I want to get it on tape because I want to put the pieces of the puzzle together. When it's in chaos and dismay, you can't put it together. But at least you can kind of see a little bit more clearly in that murky mess what's going on. But no, I mean, you have to talk to people. You have to listen to what people have to say, because sometimes there is truth within the lie, or the lie within the truth. I don't know.
You know, one of the reasons I love the Commonwealth Club audiences is because they have such good questions.
I'm scared.
So here's another one. Can you comment on Trump's attack on female reporters?
Thank you.
Is this workplace harassment?
So you're talking about what happened today.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I am livid about that.
Why don't you bring some folks up to speed, maybe?
Okay. How many of you watched it today? How many of you heard the news accounts of it today? Okay. There's a large portion that don't know. Okay. Cecilia Vega and Caitlin Collins. Cecilia from ABC and Caitlin from CNN. Caitlin just was in the news a couple of weeks ago asking questions in the Oval Office, and he wouldn't answer when he answers other people's questions in the Oval Office. As reporters, we are supposed to question. And here's the thing, these press conferences, up until now, I mean, when did they have press conferences just on one issue? There are thousands of issues that are happening at one moment in time. The White House is where everything comes, war and peace and everything in between. And it's not just a moment that it's just this. We got North Korea out there. We've got Kavanaugh. We've got voting issues. We've got midterm. We got so much stuff on the table. And that's not even, we've got China. We've got Iran. We've got a lot of stuff on. We got water that's still not safe to drink. You know, we've got Nike, you know. We've got stuff out there, you know. We got the Steelers that lost to the Ravens last night. Go Ravens. So anyway, so the president decides to shut Caitlin down by saying, that's not, no, we're talking about this. And he was just really nasty to her. Cecilia gets up and says something. What did she say? I'm confused. Something along that line. He said, yeah, you don't know what you're doing, or something along that line. On international television, demeaning this woman. And you know what happens now? When people see Cecilia, they're going to say that to her. Mm-hmm. And it was taken out of context because she may have been confused with who he was going to or something. So I wasn't there today because I was coming here to be with you. But when I saw it, I got on the Twitter and I went off, because it makes not one ounce of sense. Ooh, it makes not 1 ounce of sense. Because I'm gonna tell you, because there's residue from that stuff. When Sarah and the president do that stuff to me, I get death threats. Yeah, it's real. And that's all I'm gonna say. But women are important. Men are important, but women are so important. And at a time such as this, hear me, less than 6 weeks out from a midterm election, I don't care who you vote for, but vote. But 6 weeks, thank you. 6 weeks, too many people were bruised, bloodied, and had hoses burning their flesh and dogs tearing their skin. For the right for us to vote. And I'm sorry, vote, please. Black, white, Jew, Gentile, Protestant, and Catholic, go to those polls. Politics is personal, but go vote your personal whatever. So here's the deal. Less than 6 weeks out of an election. Now, this is from a reporter stance. This is from a human stance. And this is from a woman stance. This is from a White House correspondent stance. And from a dean of the White House press corps whose voice means something, who covers them. Okay. Yes, I might be 2 years old, but I still cover them. So let me say this to you. It bothers me because they demean us. They're not, he might do it to Jim Acosta, but he's doing it to women. He's done it to me. These women are credible. They ask great questions. What the problem is, they're angry. They are angry at the questions we ask because they know we are making a difference. Yeah. And that's one thing that Steve Bannon, and when I said we're making a difference, people are listening and they're listening with a critical ear to understand. We're not asking these questions. Oh, well, Mr. President, what did you think about the wind today? Was it too windy? No, we're asking real questions about Kavanaugh at a time. And for this president to react, this is another thing, for this president, this Republican president to react like that against the White House press corps at a time when we're less than 6 weeks out from an election and his party is losing women and independence. He's not thinking about his party or his obligations to the White House. He's thinking about his person. That's from political and reporting analysis that I've seen over the 2 years. I'm up close with him. So now, then at a time when we're dealing with Kavanaugh, this makes a difference with Kavanaugh. I'm going to tell you why. You got women out here who are crying because they have been sexually assaulted and felt Dr. Ford's pain. And Dr. Ford is looking to this president, this leader of the free world, for help with the FBI, and he's downing women. How does that make her feel and women feel? Those are the things that are on the table. This is a historic moment in time. It's not about playing this press conference. It's about doing the press conference. It's not about going against women. And I'm going to tell you, the Republican Party is going to take a hit for that today. There's a poll from CNN that says that they don't like how the president is treating the press. I was one of the first ones that people started seeing. They saw this today. They saw, you can't change, you know, everybody wants to shift history, but this, you saw this. If you didn't see it, Google it, YouTube it. Mm-hmm. I'm serious. It's painful to watch. It makes me feel like we're back in caveman days. Women are objectified. We don't mean anything. But, you know, it's not about our gender. It's about us being credible journalists that you trust. Mm-hmm. And disrespected like that by the leader of the free world and those white men. And I'm not saying this in a disparaging way, but those white men, because Washington is a male, white male dominated town. And those were women. They're women and minorities don't fare well in that town. And we, for every stride that we make, we'll pull back. Those white men that were standing behind him, smirking and laughing, mm-hmm. did not help the situation. So all of them need to be called out. April. And I'm a lover of everyone.
I hear you.
I have friends of all races, creeds, everything. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to tell you, I believe in everyone being on the same footing. I believe in equality. Right. And I believe in calling it out when it ain't right.
Go on, April.
And that's when you call it out, that's a part of the American democracy, what we were founded on. We the people who are still forming a more perfect union. We're going through growing pains right now. And the only way to fix it is to call it out. Mm-hmm. And that's part of freedom of the press. That's why part of the First Amendment of the Constitution. And if we don't call it, if we just sit there and let it happen, the First Amendment, the freedom of the press part is going to be gone. We got to, our founding fathers, these wonderful men who I'm sure had slaves, did not anticipate April Ryan, a descendant of a slave, to be questioning an American president. I stand on what they wrote. They didn't expect that they were going to have a Barack Obama or a Donald Trump as president. But we still stand on what they said. This president took an oath of office to uphold the Constitution on January 21, 2017. And that part, there's a problem. We need to call it out. Because if they suppress us and shut us down, you're not going to get the information. It's not about us. It's about you. Freedom of the press is about your freedom of information from the highest office in the land and transparency. Because right now you're not having press briefings. And you're not saying nothing.
True.
I like how I'm like, yeah.
Another question for you, April. After all the insults and lies at White House press conferences, has the press considered not attending and holding their own conference?
And who's going to be there? We're going to hold our own press conference. Okay. No, let me say this to you. I've heard everyone talk about you should boycott. No.
No boycott.
No boycott. I'm going to tell you why. As soon as we walk out those doors to boycott, they're going to shut the doors on us. And every time we lose ground, we don't gain it back. So we have got to stand. We have got to continue. When they come with a lie or a spin, we've got to come back with a fact. We got to fact check. We are not going. Our boycott, our protest is to fight back with fact. They are warring on us. We are not. Our fight is information. We can't be out. We hate the press. We hate the press. No, I still have respect for the office. I still have respect for him. But I'm going to call you out when you're wrong.
That's right. But do you think the free press can survive 2 or 6 more years of Trump?
The only way we can do it is if that press corps. I'm praying for the press corps because what we saw today when Caitlin Collins was up, you know, the reporter took the mic. There are a lot of young people in there who just got this job. And they're just happy to be around the President of the United States. There's some conservative reporters now there who ask those softball questions. And there are some liberal reporters there who are like, I hate you. Tell me what you're going to do, you know? And then there's some like me who are like, I just want the facts and get all sides of the story. We are so fractured in that room now. I mean, when I came into the White House briefing room, God bless her. Helen Thomas was there. Sam Donaldson and his loud mouth. Ooh, I love Sam. I learned how to project my voice through Sam. I used to watch him. I'm like, Mr. President! Oh, gosh. Ann Compton, Bill Plant. I mean, I worked with some of the greats. And the sad thing is that Bill Plant, I saw him at the White House Correspondent, the last White House Correspondent Association dinner. He said, you're the last of us. I was like, wow, Bill. I said, what do you mean? He said, no, they're not doing what we did. And my heart broke when he said that. I'm praying for the press corps. I don't know. It's a different day. We now have people who have blogs who just show up at the White House, you know, citizen journalists. I'm like, where did you get your understanding of journalism? I mean, when I grew up, it was the what's, when's, where's, why's, and how's. You know, that ruled the news and all the sides of the story, not just two sides. But now it's like, I think. We need more fact-based journalism and more real journalists. Leave the editorial stuff aside.
So, April, what advice do you have for young women who want to make their voices heard and, I should say, believed? In male-dominated offices and in the boardrooms?
One, I hate to say this, but don't cry. Don't let them see you cry.
Men cry.
Okay.
Haven't all cried.
Okay, but let me say this. They can cry, but it's okay. But when we cry, look at her. They think we're weak. And it's sad. You can still be very feminine and figure out how to express yourself without those tears coming out.
Have you had to hold them back?
Oh, my God, yes. I had someone tell me the only reason why, and you read it in the book, the only reason why I get called on is because I'm black. That was a day I wanted to cry and swing. Mm-hmm. I had to hold both. I'm from Baltimore. I was going to give a good Baltimore drag, but I said, for those of you who don't know what a drag is, Google it. But or watch a reality show. You'll find out what it is. No, there were times I wanted to cry. There were times I felt left out. And this is one thing that Helen Thomas said, and I wrote it in one of my books. Men talk to men. Washington is a male-dominated town, and then a white male-dominated town. I don't fit into that category. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I stand alone. A lot of times I'm alone. A lot of times I'm alone.
I don't like
it. It's terrible, but you know what? You get over it. Yeah. And you just do your job. I mean, beyond the White House, I have a community of friends. I have a community of support. I have supporters in many different networks, but it's so different in Washington. It's so, and I'm not going to say that because you know what? I hear it. I have women who've come to me crying, saying that they've had the same. I said, sister, don't cry. Stand up. I said, stand up and see it for what it is. And then you know how to engage. Once you can step back from the emotion of it and really look and assess the lay of the land, because I know why the attacks are happening to me. Because at first I wanted to cry. That day that Sean told me to stop shaking my head, I said, yeah. I'd had Omarosa going after me. And then the president said, get them together. And then Sean was like, stop shaking your head. I was like, what do they think I am? I said, oh my God, this is the worst day. And I talked to people and said, I've never heard you like this. And they would never, I never let anyone see me cry, but I was upset. Mm-hmm. But I pulled back and I saw it for what it was. I am not the base or perceived base of this administration. And they wanted to use me as an example to say, we're giving it to the press. And they thought that they were going to make me fall because I am from an urban network, a smaller network, and I'm a woman by myself. Well, now about a year and some in, they're like, I didn't know she was going to be as formidable as she was, as she is. So don't cry.
Right on.
Just assess the lay of the land and then you engage. Don't use the emotion when you try to figure out your path through the murky waters.
What are your thoughts on the state of conservatism in the U.S., especially for the black community?
What are my thoughts? I mean, I have no thoughts about it. I think it's healthy that we have people of differing opinions. I think it's healthy when conservatives court black America. But I think it's also healthy when the far left court black America. But I think it's healthier when these groups really do something for black America. The black community is an untapped community. Yeah, they're the Democratic base. But if people really wanted to do something in the black community, they would have so much. It would be so much of a fuller plate, a richer plate, mm-hmm. because there's so much to bring to the table. In the black community, there is entrepreneurship. You know, white America calls it entrepreneurship. We call it the hustle. You know, there are a lot of people who believe in the ideals of the Republican Party, but will not become Republicans because of what's happening now, the idea of racism or the perceived racism or what we see as racism. So I believe that the black community has been taken for granted by both parties, and I think they should be courted. And I think that black people need to start holding, not just black people, but brown people as well. All people should hold these political leaders accountable. Not just go to the polls on election day and say, that's it, they didn't do anything for me. Why aren't they doing anything? You haven't made them do something for mm-hmm. you. And watching from the unique person I've been sitting in for 21 years, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. Mm-hmm. Once you start marching consistently and persistently, they listen. They don't want you squeaking. So they'll give you, I mean, let's take, for example, Parkland.
Mm-hmm.
Another example was zero tolerance. When they pulled our babies, those mm-hmm. babies away from their mamas. And right now, how many of those children are not going to see their mother? They're not going to be able, they can't find their parents. It's ridiculous.
Thousands.
And there's not an outcry. We forgot.
Mm-mm.
And then look at what's happening now with Kavanaugh. Congressman Elijah Cummings from Maryland, who is the minority leader in government oversight and reform, said this is guerrilla warfare. He said it's going to take the American public to make a difference on Kavanaugh. The Kavanaugh nomination is in jeopardy, but what will tilt the scale, it's not the FBI investigation, it's you. Because all the president has to do is say, I'm withdrawing this nomination
mm-hmm.
because he heard from you overwhelmingly. It's in jeopardy right now. But the question is, how will this go? I can't see them pushing this thing through with all this hurt and these questions that are still lingering in the air. Just as a reporter, I mean, I've heard from so many women who are crying out, you know, and what's crazy is, Judge, I watched with all of you. I was like sitting there. People were eating popcorn. I mean, I've never seen this. I mean, you know, people were, it was like, ooh, this is good. You know, it was like, I was watching. I'm like, what in the world? But what really gets me about this is before they were supposed to take that vote, Suzanne Malveaux from CNN, dear friend mm-hmm. of mine, mm-hmm. it was just the stars that lined up. If she had not had her camera and followed those women who ran into that elevator and found Flake didn't shut that door because those cameras were there.
That's what freedom of the press is. That is transparency at its best. You saw what happened. You saw Flake, like, oh my God. He didn't shut that door because those cameras were there.
Those cameras were there. You saw it. Those women were given their truth. And he couldn't. Sometimes when you give people can't handle your truth. And you saw he was vexed.
Yes.
When he went back into that chamber. And then he pulled Chris Coons out. Come here. Let's go talk. You saw it. What happens if they shut us down? You saw step by step. That's what we do. That is journalism excellence. And now the nation, the world is riveted to this. So that's what we do. We may do a lot of things, you know, that y'all don't like, but that's what we do.
Wow. So we have time for one final question, but not a question. I know, time flew here.
It's 65 minutes already.
That's right.
Oh my gosh, it's been so much fun with you guys.
So
stay, you want to bring my children with me? You want to fly my children out? Okay, she said okay.
So April, some of the most compelling words I have ever read about the importance of a free press are in your book and on page 102. So what I'd like you to do, if you don't mind, is to close our conversation with your reading this wonderful and inspiring passage. And I have turned to page 102.
Thank you so much. Okay. I'll continue to press for information. I stand with my fellow journalists who persevere regardless of the issue or the obstacle. More than ever before, a free press is needed to offer truth and expose what's done in the dark. We're not freedom fighters or in the resistance, just people who are proud to tell the truth with pen and paper rather than the sword. Please stand with me, with the White House Press Corps and beyond, to support freedom of the press.
And so And I'm Judge Cordell, and I approve that message.
Oh, yes.
You're welcome. So our thanks to April Ryan, White House reporter and author of the new book, Under Fire, reporting from the front lines of the Trump White House. Make sure you get this book. It is
yes.
a terrific read. Terrific read. So I'm Ladaris Cordell, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Judge. Thank you so much.